This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. Read for you by Joe Morton. Invisible Man. I am an invisible man. No, I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe. Nor am I one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fiber and liquids, and I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. Like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows, it is as though I have been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me. Nor is my invisibility exactly a matter of a biochemical accident to my epidermis. That invisibility to which I refer occurs because of a peculiar disposition of the eyes of those with whom I come in contact. A matter of the construction of their inner eyes. Those eyes with which they look through their physical eyes upon reality. I am not complaining, nor am I protesting either. It is sometimes advantageous to be unseen, although it is most often rather wearing on the nerves. Then, too, you're constantly being bumped against by those of poor vision, or, again, you often doubt if you really exist. You wonder whether you aren't simply a phantom in other people's minds, say a figure in a nightmare, which the sleeper tries with all his strength to destroy. It's when you feel like this that, out of resentment, you begin to bump people back. And let me confess, you feel that way most of the time. You ache with the need to convince yourself that you do exist in the real world, that you're part of all the sound and anguish, and you strike out with your fists, you curse and you swear to make them recognize you. And alas, it's seldom successful. One night, I accidentally bumped into a man, and perhaps because of the near darkness, he saw me and called me an insulting name. I sprang at him, seized his coat lapels, and demanded that he apologize. He was a tall, blond man, and as my face came close to his, he looked insolently out of his blue eyes and cursed me, his breath hot in my face as he struggled. I pulled his chin down sharp upon the crown of my head, butting him as I had seen the West Indians do, and I felt his flesh tear and the blood gush out, and I yelled, "Apologize! Apologize!" But he continued to curse and struggle, and I butted him again and again until he went down heavily on his knees, profusely bleeding. I kicked him repeatedly in a frenzy because he still uttered insults, though his lips were frothy with blood. Oh, yes, I kicked him. And in my outrage, I got out my knife and prepared to slit his throat right there beneath the lamplight in the deserted street, holding him in the collar with one hand and opening the knife with my teeth, when it occurred to me that the man had not seen me, actually. That he, as far as he knew, was in the midst of a walking nightmare. And I stopped the blade, slicing the air as I pushed him away, letting him fall back to the street. I stared at him hard as the lights of a car stabbed through the darkness. He lay there, moaning on the asphalt, a man almost killed by a phantom. It unnerved me. I was both disgusted and ashamed. I was like a drunken man myself, wavering about on weakened legs. Then I was amused. Something in this man's thick head had sprung out and beaten him within an inch of his life. I began to laugh at this crazy discovery. Would he have awakened at the point of death? Would death himself have freed him for wakeful living? But I didn't linger. I ran away into the dark, laughing so hard I feared I might rupture myself. The next day I saw his picture in the Daily News beneath a caption stating that he had been mugged. Poor fool. Poor blind fool, I thought with sincere compassion. Mugged by an invisible man. Most of the time, although I do not choose as I once did to deny the violence of my days by ignoring it, I am not so overtly violent. I remember that I am invisible and walk softly so as not to awaken the sleeping ones. Sometimes it is best not to awaken them. There are few things in the world as dangerous as sleepwalkers. I learned in time, though, that it is possible to carry on a fight against them without their realizing it. For instance, I have been carrying on a fight with monopolated light and power for some time now. I use their service and pay them nothing at all, and they don't know it. Oh, they suspect that power is being drained off, but they don't know where. All they know is that, according to the master meter back there in their power station, a hell of a lot of free current is disappearing somewhere into the jungle of Harlem. The joke, of course, is that I don't live in Harlem, but in a border area. Several years ago, before I discovered the advantages of being invisible, I went through the routine process of buying service and paying their outrageous rates. But no more. I gave up all that, along with my apartment and my old way of life. That way based upon the fallacious assumption that I, like other men, was visible. Now, aware of my invisibility, I live rent-free in a building rented strictly to whites in a section of the basement that was shut off and forgotten during the 19th century, which I discovered when I was trying to escape in the night from Ross the Destroyer. But that's getting too far ahead of the story. Well, almost to the end. Although, the end is in the beginning and lies far ahead. The point now is that I found a home. Or a hole in the ground, as you will. Now don't jump to the conclusion that because I call my home a hole, it is damp and cold like a grave. There are cold holes and warm holes. Mine is a warm hole. And remember, a bear retires to his hole for the winter and lives until spring. Then he comes strolling out like the Easter chick breaking from its shell. I say all this to assure you that it is incorrect to assume that because I'm invisible and live in a hole, I am dead. I am neither dead nor in a state of suspended animation. Call me Jack the Bear, for I am in a state of hibernation. My hole is warm and full of light, yes, full of light. I doubt if there is a brighter spot in all New York than this hole of mine, and I do not exclude Broadway or the Empire State Building on a photographer's dream night. But that is taking advantage of you. Those two spots are among the darkest of our whole civilization. Our whole culture, an important distinction I've heard. Which might sound like a hoax or a contradiction, but that, by contradiction I mean, is how the world moves. Not like an arrow, but a boomerang. Beware of those who speak of the spiral of history. They are preparing a boomerang. Keep a steel helmet handy. I know. I have been boomeranged across my head so much that I now can see the darkness of lightness. And I love light. Perhaps you'll think it strange that an invisible man should need light, desire light, love light. But maybe it is exactly because I am invisible. Light confirms my reality, gives birth to my form. A beautiful girl once told me of a recurring nightmare in which she lay in the center of a large, dark room and felt her face expand until it filled the whole room, becoming a formless mass while her eyes ran in bilious jelly up the chimney. And so it is with me. Without light, I am not only invisible but formless as well. And to be unaware of one's form is to live a death. I myself, after existing some 20 years, did not become alive until I discovered my invisibility. That is why I fight my battle with monopolated light and power. The deeper reason, I mean. It allows me to feel my vital aliveness. I also fight them for taking so much of my money before I learn to protect myself. In my hole, in the basement, there are exactly 1,369 lights. I've wired the entire ceiling, every inch of it. And not with fluorescent bulbs, but with the older, more expensive-to-operate kind. The filament type. An act of sabotage, you know. I've already begun to wire the wall. A junk man, I know, a man of vision, has supplied me with wire and sockets. Nothing. Storm or flood must get in the way of our need for light, and ever more and brighter light. The truth is the light, and light is the truth. When I finish all four walls, then I'll start on the floor. Just how that will go, I don't know. Yet, when you have lived invisible as long as I have, you develop a certain ingenuity. I'll solve the problem. And maybe I'll invent a gadget to place my coffee pot on the fire while I lie in bed, and even invent a gadget to warm my bed, like the fellow I saw in one of the picture magazines who made himself a gadget to warm his shoes. Though invisible, I am in the great American tradition of tinkers. That makes me kin to Ford, Edison, and Franklin. Call me, since I have a theory and a concept, a thinker-tinker. Yes, I'll warm my shoes. They need it. They're usually full of holes. I'll do that and more. Now I have one radio phonograph. I plan to have five. There is a certain acoustical deadness in my hole, and when I have music, I want to feel its vibration, not only with my ear, but with my whole body. I'd like to hear five recordings of Louis Armstrong playing and singing "What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue," all at the same time. Sometimes now I listen to Louis while I have my favorite dessert of vanilla ice cream and slow gin. I pour the red liquid over the white mound, watching it glisten and the vapor rising as Louis bends that military instrument into a beam of lyrical sound. Perhaps I like Louis Armstrong because he's made poetry out of being invisible. I think it must be because he's unaware that he is invisible. And my own grasp of invisibility aids me to understand his music. Once when I asked for a cigarette, some jokers gave me a reefer, which I lighted when I got home and sat listening to my phonograph. It was a strange evening. Invisibility, let me explain, gives one a slightly different sense of time. You're never quite on the beat. Sometimes you're ahead and sometimes behind. Instead of the swift and imperceptible flowing of time, you are aware of its nodes, those points where time stands still or from which it leaps ahead, and you slip into the breaks and look around. That's what you hear vaguely in Louis' music. Once I saw a prize fighter boxing a yokel. The fighter was swift and amazingly scientific. His body was one violent flow of rapid rhythmic action. He hit the yokel 100 times while the yokel held up his arms in stunned surprise. But suddenly, the yokel, rolling about in the gale of boxing gloves, struck one blow and knocked science, speed, and footwork as cold as a well-digger's posterior. The smart money hit the canvas. The long shot got the nod. The yokel had simply stepped inside of his opponent's sense of time. So, under the spell of the reefer, I discovered a new analytical way of listening to music. The unheard sounds came through, and each melodic line existed of itself, stood out clearly from all the rest, said its piece, and waited patiently for the other voices to speak. That night, I found myself hearing not only in time, but in space as well. I not only entered the music, but descended like Dante into its depths. And beneath the swiftness of the hot tempo, there was a slower tempo in a cave, and I entered it and looked around and heard an old woman singing a spiritual as full of Weltschmerz as flamenco. And beneath that lay a still lower level on which I saw a beautiful girl, the color of ivory, pleading in a voice like my mother's as she stood before a group of slave owners who bid for her naked body. And below that I found a lower level and a more rapid tempo, and I heard someone shout, "Brothers and sisters! My text this morning is the blackness of blackness." And a congregation of voices answered, "That blackness is most black, brother, most black in the beginning. At the very start," they cried, "there was blackness. Preach it!" And the sun, Lord, was bloody red. Red! Now black is, the preacher shouted. Bloody! I said it's, preach it, brother, and black ain't. Red, Lord, red! He said it's red. Amen, brother. Black will get you. Yes, it will. Yes, it will. And black won't. No, it won't. It do, Lord. And it don't. Hallelujah. It'll put your glory, glory, oh my Lord, in the whale's belly. Preach it, dear brother, and make you tempt. Good God Almighty, old Aunt Nellie, black will make you black, or black will unmake you. Ain't it the truth, Lord? And at that point, a voice of trombone timber screamed at me, get out of here, you fool! Is you ready to commit treason? And I tore myself away, hearing the old singer of spirituals moaning, go curse your God, boy, and die. I stopped and questioned her, asked her what was wrong. I dearly loved my master son, she said. You should have hated him, I said. He gave me several sons, she said. And because I loved my sons, I learned to love their father, though I hated him, too. I, too, have become acquainted with ambivalence, I said. That's why I'm here. What's that? Nothing. A word that doesn't explain it. Why do you moan? I moan this way, 'cause he's dead, she said. Then tell me, who is that laughing upstairs? Them's my sons. They glad. Yes, I can understand that, too, I said. I laughs, too, but I moans, too. He promised to set us free, but he never could bring himself to do it. Still, I loved him. Loved him? You mean, oh, yes. But I loved something else even more. What more? Freedom. Freedom, I said. Maybe freedom lies in hating. No, son. It's in loving. I loved him. And give him the poison, and he withered away like a frostbit apple. Them boys would have tore him to pieces with their homemade knives. A mistake was made somewhere, I said. I'm confused. And I wished to say other things, but the laughter upstairs became too loud and moan-like for me, and I tried to break out of it, but I couldn't. Just as I was leaving, I felt an urgent desire to ask her what freedom was, and went back. She sat with her head in her hands, moaning softly. Her leather-brown face was filled with sadness. Old woman, what is this freedom you love so well? I asked around a corner of my mind. She looked surprised, then thoughtful, then baffled. I done forgot, son. It's all mixed up. First I think it's one thing, then I think it's another. It gets my head to spinning. I guess now it ain't nothing but knowing how to say what I got up in my head. But it's a hard job, son. Too much has done happened to me in too short a time. It's like I have a fever. Every time I start to walk, my head gets to swirling and I falls down. Or if it ain't that, it's the boys. They gets to laughing and wants to kill up the white folks. They's bitter. That's what they is. But what about freedom? Leave me alone, boy, my head aches. I left her, feeling dizzy myself. I didn't get far. Suddenly, one of the sons, a big fellow, 6 feet tall, appeared out of nowhere and struck me with his fist. What's the matter, man? I cried. You made Ma cry. But how? I said, dodging a blow. Asking her them questions, that's how. Get out of here and stay, and next time you got questions like that, ask yourself. He held me in a grip like cold stone, his fingers fastening upon my windpipe until I thought I would suffocate before he finally allowed me to go. I stumbled about, dazed, the music beating hysterically in my ears. It was dark, my head cleared, and I wandered down a dark, narrow passage, thinking I heard his footsteps hurrying behind me. I was sore, and into my being had come a profound craving for tranquility, for peace and quiet, a state I felt I could never achieve. For one thing, the trumpet was blaring and the rhythm was too hectic. A tom-tom beating like heart thuds began drowning out the trumpet, filling my ears. I longed for water. And I heard it, rushing through the cold mains my fingers touched as I felt my way. But I couldn't stop to search because of the footsteps behind me. Hey, Ross, I called. Is it you, Destroyer? Reinhardt? No answer. Only the rhythmic footsteps behind me. Once I tried crossing the road, but a speeding machine struck me, scraping the skin from my leg as it roared past. Then, somehow, I came out of it, ascending hastily from this underworld of sound to hear Louis Armstrong innocently asking, "What did I do to be so black and blue?" At first, I was afraid. This familiar music had demanded action, the kind of which I was incapable, and yet, had I lingered there beneath the surface, I might have attempted to act. Nevertheless, I know now that few really listen to this music. I sat on the chair's edge in a soaking sweat as though each of my 1,369 bulbs had every one become a clique light in an individual setting for a third degree with Ross and Reinhardt in charge. It was exhausting, as though I had held my breath continuously for an hour under the terrifying serenity that comes from days of intense hunger. And yet, it was a strangely satisfying experience for an invisible man to hear the silence of sound. I had discovered unrecognized compulsions of my being, even though I could not answer yes to their promptings. I haven't smoked a reefer since. However, not because they're illegal, but because to see around corners is enough. That is not unusual when you are invisible, but to hear around them is too much. It inhibits action. And despite Brother Jack and all that sad, lost period of the Brotherhood, I believe in nothing if not in action. Please, a definition. A hibernation is a covert preparation for a more overt action. Besides, the drug destroys one's sense of time completely. If that happened, I might forget to dodge some bright morning, and some cluck would run me down with an orange and yellow streetcar or a bilious bus, or I might forget to leave my hole when the moment for action presents itself. Meanwhile, I enjoy my life with the compliments of monopolated light and power. Since you never recognize me, even when in closest contact with me, and since no doubt you'll hardly believe that I exist, it won't matter if you know that I tapped a power line leading into the building and ran it into my hole in the ground. Before that, I lived in the darkness into which I was chased. But now I see. I've illuminated the blackness of my invisibility, and vice versa. And so, I play the invisible music of my isolation. The last statement doesn't seem just right, does it? But it is. You hear this music simply because music is heard and seldom seen, except by musicians. Could this compulsion to put invisibility down in black and white be thus an urge to make music of invisibility? But I am an orator, a rabble-rouser. Am. I was, and perhaps shall be again, who knows? All sickness is not unto death, neither is invisibility. I can hear you say, what a horrible, irresponsible bastard, and you're right, I leap to agree with you. I'm one of the most irresponsible beings that ever lived. Irresponsibility is part of my invisibility. Any way you face it, it is a denial. But to whom can I be responsible, and why should I be, when you refuse to see me? And wait until I reveal how truly irresponsible I am. Responsibility rests upon recognition, and recognition is a form of agreement. Take the man whom I almost killed. Who was responsible for that near murder? I don't think so, and I refuse it. I won't buy it. You can't give it to me. He bumped me. He insulted me. Shouldn't he, for his own personal safety, have recognized my hysteria, my danger potential? He, let us say, was lost in a dream world. But didn't he control that dream world, which, alas, is only too real? And didn't he rule me out of it? And if he had yelled for a policeman, wouldn't I have been taken for the offending one? Yes, yes, yes. Let me agree with you. I was the irresponsible one, for I should have used my knife. to protect the higher interests of society. Someday that kind of foolishness will cause us tragic trouble. All dreamers and sleepwalkers must pay the price, and even the invisible victim is responsible for the fate of all. But I shirked that responsibility. I became too snarled in the incompatible notions that buzzed within my brain. I was a coward. But what did I do to be so blue? Bear with me. It goes a long way back, some 20 years. All my life I have been looking for something, and everywhere I turned, someone tried to tell me what it was. I accepted their answers, too, though they were often in contradiction and even self-contradictory. I was naive. I was looking for myself and asking everyone except myself questions which I, and only I, could answer. It took me a long time and much painful boomeranging of my expectations to achieve a realization everyone else appears to have been born with. That I am nobody but myself. But first I had to discover that I am an invisible man. And yet I am no freak of nature, nor of history. I was in the cards. Other things having been equal or unequal 85 years ago. I am not ashamed of my grandparents for having been slaves. I am only ashamed of myself for having at one time been ashamed. About 85 years ago, they were told that they were free, united with others of our country in everything pertaining to the common good and in everything social, separate, like the fingers of the hand. And they believed it. They exulted in it. They stayed in their place, worked hard, and brought up my father to do the same. But my grandfather is the one. He was an odd old guy, my grandfather, and I am told I take after him. It was he who caused the trouble. On his deathbed, he called my father to him and said, "Son, after I'm gone, I want you to keep up the good fight. I never told you, but our life is a war, and I have been a traitor all my born days, a spy in the enemy's country ever since I gave up my gun back in the Reconstruction. Live with your head in the lion's mouth. I want you to overcome him with yeses, undermine him with grins, agree him to death and destruction, let him swallow you till they vomit or bust wide open." They thought the old man had gone out of his mind. He had been the meekest of men. The younger children were rushed from the room, the shades were drawn, the flame of the lamp turned so low that it sputtered on the wick like the old man's breathing. "Learn it to the young'uns," he whispered fiercely. Then he died. But my folks were more alarmed over his last words than over his dying. It was as though he had not died at all. His words caused so much anxiety. I was warned emphatically to forget what he had said, and indeed, this is the first time it has been mentioned outside the family circle. It had a tremendous effect upon me, however. I could never be sure of what he meant. Grandfather had been a quiet old man who never made any trouble, yet on his deathbed he had called himself a traitor and a spy, and he had spoken of his meekness as a dangerous activity. It became a constant puzzle which lay unanswered in the back of my mind. And whenever things went well for me, I remembered my grandfather and felt guilty and uncomfortable. It was as though I was carrying out his advice in spite of myself. And to make it worse, everyone loved me for it. I was praised by the most lily-white men of the town. I was considered an example of desirable conduct, just as my grandfather had been. And what puzzled me was that the old man had defined it as treachery. When I was praised for my conduct, I felt a guilt that in some way I was doing something that was really against the wishes of the white folks, that if they had understood, they would have desired me to act just the opposite, that I should have been sulky and mean, and that that really would have been what they wanted, even though they were fooled and thought they wanted me to act as I did. It made me afraid that someday they would look upon me as a traitor and I would be lost. Still, I was more afraid to act any other way because they didn't like that at all. The old man's words were like a curse. On my graduation day, I delivered an oration in which I showed that humility was the secret, indeed the very essence of progress. Not that I believed this. How could I, remembering my grandfather? I only believed that it worked. It was a great success. Everyone praised me, and I was invited to give the speech at a gathering of the town's leading white citizens. It was a triumph for our whole community. It was in the main ballroom of the leading hotel. When I got there, I discovered that it was on the occasion of a smoker, and I was told that since I was to be there anyway, I might as well take part in the battle royal to be fought by some of my schoolmates as part of the entertainment. The battle royal came first. All of the town's big shots were there, in their tuxedos, wolfing down the buffet foods, drinking beer and whiskey, and smoking black cigars. It was a large room with a high ceiling. Chairs were arranged in neat rows around three sides of a portable boxing ring. The fourth side was clear, revealing a gleaming space of polished floor. I had some misgivings over the battle royal, by the way. Not from a distaste for fighting, but because I didn't care too much for the other fellows who were to take part. They were tough guys who seemed to have no grandfather's curse worrying their minds. No one could mistake their toughness, and besides, I suspected that fighting a battle royal might detract from the dignity of my speech. In those pre-invisible days, I visualized myself as a potential Booker T. Washington. But the other fellows didn't care too much for me, either, and there were nine of them. I felt superior to them in my way, and I didn't like the manner in which we were all crowded together into the servants' elevator. Nor did they like my being there. In fact, as the warmly lighted floors flashed past the elevator, we had words over the fact that I, by taking part in the fight, had knocked one of their friends out of a night's work. We were led out of the elevator through a rococo hall into an anteroom and told to get into our fighting togs. Each of us was issued a pair of boxing gloves and ushered out into the big mirrored hall, which we entered looking cautiously about us and whispering lest we might accidentally be heard above the noise of the room. It was foggy with cigar smoke, and already the whiskey was taking effect. I was shocked to see some of the most important men of the town quite tipsy. They were all there, bankers, lawyers, judges, doctors, fire chiefs, teachers, merchants, even one of the more fashionable pastors. Something we could not see was going on up front. A clarinet was vibrating sensuously, and the men were standing up and moving eagerly forward. We were a small, tight group clustered together, our bare upper bodies touching and shining with anticipatory sweat. While up front, the big shots were becoming increasingly excited over something we still could not see. Suddenly I heard the school superintendent, who had told me to come, yell, "Bring up the shines, gentlemen! Bring up the little shines!" We were rushed up to the front of the ballroom, where it smelled even more strongly of tobacco and whiskey. Then we were pushed into place. I almost wet my pants. A sea of faces, some hostile, some amused, ringed around us, and in the center, facing us, stood a magnificent, blonde, stark naked. There was dead silence. I felt a blast of cold air chill me. I tried to back away, but they were behind me and around me. Some of the boys stood with lowered heads, trembling. I felt a wave of irrational guilt and fear. My teeth chattered, my skin turned to goose flesh, my knees knocked. Yet I was strongly attracted and looked in spite of myself. Had the price of looking been blindness, I would have looked. The hair was yellow like that of a circus Cupid doll. The face heavily powdered and rouged as though to form an abstract mask. The eyes hollow and smeared a cool blue, the color of a baboon's butt. I felt a desire to spit upon her as my eyes brushed slowly over her body. Her breasts were firm and round as the domes of East Indian temples, and I stood so close as to see the fine skin texture and beads of pearly perspiration glistening like dew around the pink and erect buds of her nipples. I wanted at one and the same time to run from the room, to sink through the floor, or go to her and cover her from my eyes and the eyes of the others with my body, to feel the soft thighs, to caress her and destroy her, to love her and murder her, to hide from her, and yet to stroke where, below the small American flag tattooed upon her belly, her thighs formed a capital V. I had a notion that, of all in the room, she saw only me with her impersonal eyes. And then she began to dance, a slow, sensuous movement, the smoke of 100 cigars clinging to her like the thinnest of veils. She seemed like a fair bird girl, girdled in veils, calling to me from the angry surface of some gray and threatening sea. I was transported. Then I became aware of the clarinet playing, and the big shots yelling at us. Some threatened us if we looked, and others if we did not. On my right, I saw one boy faint, and now a man grabbed a silver pitcher from a table and stepped close as he dashed ice water upon him, and stood him up and forced two of us to support him as his head hung and moans issued from his thick, bluish lips. Another boy began to plead to go home. He was the largest of the group, wearing dark red fighting trunks, much too small to conceal the erection which projected from him as though in answer to the insinuating, low-registered moaning of the clarinet. He tried to hide himself with his boxing gloves, and all the while, the blonde continued dancing, smiling faintly at the big shots who watched her with fascination, and faintly smiling at our fear. I noticed a certain merchant who followed her hungrily, his lips loose and drooling. He was a large man who wore diamond studs in a shirt front which swelled with the ample paunch underneath, and each time the blonde swayed her undulating hips, he ran his hand through the thin hair of his bald head, and with his arms upheld, his posture clumsy like that of an intoxicated panda, wound his belly in a slow and obscene grind. This creature was completely hypnotized. The music had quickened. As the dancer flung herself about with a detached expression on her face, the men began reaching out to touch her. I could see their beefy fingers sink into the soft flesh. Some of the others tried to stop them, and she began to move around the floor in graceful circles as they gave chase, slipping and sliding over the polished floor. It was mad. Chairs went crashing, drinks were spilled as they ran laughing and howling after her. They caught her just as she reached a door, raised her from the floor, and tossed her as college boys are tossed at a hazing. And above her red, fixed, smiling lips, I saw the terror and disgust in her eyes, almost like my own terror and that which I saw in some of the other boys. As I watched, they tossed her twice, and her soft breast seemed to flatten against the air, and her legs flung wildly as she spun. Some of the more sober ones helped her to escape. And I started off the floor, heading for the anteroom with the rest of the boys. Some were still crying and in hysteria, but as we tried to leave, we were stopped and ordered to get into the ring. There was nothing to do but what we were told. All 10 of us climbed under the ropes and allowed ourselves to be blindfolded with broad bands of white cloth. One of the men seemed to feel a bit sympathetic and tried to cheer us up as we stood with our backs against the ropes. Some of us tried to grin. "See that boy over there?" one of the men said. "I want you to run across at the bell and give it to him right in the belly. If you don't get him, I'm going to get you. I don't like his looks." Each of us was told the same. The blindfolds were put on, yet even then I had been going over my speech. In my mind, each word was as bright as flame. I felt the cloth pressed into place and frowned so that it would be loosened when I relaxed. But now I felt a sudden fit of blind terror. I was unused to darkness. It was as though I had suddenly found myself in a dark room filled with poisonous cotton mouths. I could hear the bleary voices yelling insistently for the battle royal to begin. "Get going in there! Let me at that big nigger!" I strained to pick up the school superintendent's voice, as though to squeeze some security out of that slightly more familiar sound. "Let me at those black sons of bitches," someone yelled. "No, Jackson, no," another voice yelled. "Here, somebody, help me hold Jack. I want to get at that ginger-colored nigger. Tear him limb from limb," the first voice yelled. I stood against the ropes, trembling, for in those days I was what they called ginger-colored, and he sounded as though he might crunch me between his teeth like a crisp ginger cookie. Quite a struggle was going on. Chairs were being kicked about, and I could hear voices grunting as with a terrific effort. I wanted to see more desperately than ever before, but the blindfold was tight as a thick skin puckering scab, and when I raised my gloved hands to push the layers of white aside, a voice yelled, "Oh, no, you don't, black bastard, leave that alone! Ring the bell before Jackson kills him, a coon!" someone boomed in the sudden silence, and I heard the bell clang and the sound of the feet scuffling forward. A glove smacked against my head. I pivoted, striking out stiffly as someone went past, and felt the jar ripple along the length of my arm to my shoulder. Then it seemed as though all nine of the boys had turned upon me at once. Blows pounded me from all sides while I struck out as best I could. So many blows landed upon me that I wondered if I were not the only blindfolded fighter in the ring, or if the man called Jackson hadn't succeeded in getting me after all. Blindfolded, I could no longer control my motions. I had no dignity. I stumbled about like a baby or a drunken man. The smoke had become thicker, and with each new blow it seemed to sear and further restrict my lungs. My saliva became like hot, bitter glue. A glove connected with my head, filling my mouth with warm blood. It was everywhere. I could not tell if the moisture I felt upon my body was sweat or blood. A blow landed hard against the nape of my neck. I felt myself going over, my head hitting the floor. Streaks of blue light filled the black world behind the blindfold. I lay prone, pretending I was knocked out, but felt myself seized by hands and yanked to my feet. "Get going, black boy, mix it up!" My arms were like lead, my head smarting from blows. I managed to feel my way to the ropes and held on, trying to catch my breath. A glove landed in my midsection, and I went over again, feeling as though the smoke had become a knife jabbed into my guts. Pushed this way and that by the legs milling around me, I finally pulled erect and discovered that I could see the black, sweat-washed forms weaving in the smoky blue atmosphere like drunken dancers weaving to the rapid drum-like thuds of blows. Everyone fought hysterically. It was complete anarchy. Everybody fought everybody else. No group fought together for long. Two, three, four fought one, then turned to fight each other, with themselves attacked. Blows landed below the belt and in the kidney, with the gloves open as well as closed, and with my eye partly open now, there was not so much terror. I moved carefully, avoiding blows, although not too many to attract attention, fighting from group to group. The boys groped about like blind, cautious crabs, crouching to protect their midsections, their heads pulled in short against their shoulders, their arms stretched nervously before them, with their fists testing the smoke-filled air like the knobbed feelers of hypersensitive snails. In one corner, I glimpsed a boy violently punching the air and heard him scream in pain as he smashed his hand against the ring post. For a second, I saw him bent over, holding his hand and going down as a blow caught his unprotected head. I played one group against the other, slipping in and throwing a punch, then stepping out of range while pushing the others into the melee to take the blows blindly aimed at me. The smoke was agonizing, and there were no rounds, no bells at 3-minute intervals to relieve our exhaustion. The room spun around me, a swirl of light, smoke, sweating bodies surrounded by tense white faces. I bled from both nose and mouth, the blood spattering upon my chest. The men kept yelling, "Slug him, black boy, knock his guts out! Uppercut him! Kill that big boy!" Taking a fake fall, I saw a boy going down heavily beside me as though we were felled by a single blow. Saw a sneaker-clad foot shoot into his groin as the two who had knocked him down stumbled upon him. I rolled out of range, feeling a twinge of nausea. The harder we fought, the more threatening the men became, and yet I had begun to worry about my speech again. How would it go? Would they recognize my ability? What would they give me? I was fighting automatically when suddenly I noticed that one after another of the boys was leaving the ring. I was surprised, filled with panic, as though I had been left alone with an unknown danger. Then I understood. The boys had arranged it among themselves. It was the custom for the two men left in the ring to slug it out for the winner's prize. I discovered this too late. When the bell sounded, two men in tuxedos leaped into the ring and removed the blindfold. I found myself facing Tatlock, the biggest of the gang. I felt sick at my stomach. Hardly had the bell stopped ringing in my ears than it clanged again, and I saw him moving swiftly toward me. Thinking of nothing else to do, I hit him smash on the nose. He kept coming, bringing the rank, sharp violence of stale sweat. His face was a black blank of a face, only his eyes alive, with hate of me and aglow with a feverish terror from what had happened to us all. I became anxious. I wanted to deliver my speech, and he came at me as though he meant to beat it out of me. I smashed him again and again, taking his blows as they came. Then, on a sudden impulse, I struck him lightly, and as we clinched, I whispered, "Fake like I knocked you out. You can have the prize." "I'll break your behind," he whispered hoarsely. "For them? For me, son of a bitch." They were yelling for us to break it up, and Tatlock spun me half around with a blow, and as a joggled camera sweeps in a reeling scene, I saw the howling red faces crouching, tense, beneath a cloud of blue-gray smoke. For a moment the world wavered, unraveled, flowed, then my head cleared and Tatlock bounced before me. That fluttering shadow before my eyes was his jabbing left hand. Then falling forward, my head against his damp shoulder, I whispered, "I'll make it $5 more. Go to hell!" But his muscles relaxed a trifle beneath my pressure, and I breathed, "Seven? Give it to your ma," he said, ripping me beneath the heart. And while I still held him, I butted him and moved away. I felt myself bombarded with punches. I fought back with hopeless desperation. I wanted to deliver my speech more than anything else in the world, because I felt that only these men could judge truly my ability. And now this stupid clown was ruining my chances. I began fighting carefully now, moving in to punch him and out again with my greater speed. A lucky blow to his chin, and I had him going, too, until I heard a loud voice yell, "I got my money on the big boy!" Hearing this, I almost dropped my guard. I was confused. Should I try to win against the voice out there? Would not this go against my speech? And was not this a moment for humility, for non-resistance? A blow to my head as I danced about sent my right eye popping like a jack-in-the-box and settled my dilemma. The room went red as I fell. It was a dream fall, my body languid and fastidious as to where to land until the floor became impatient and smashed up to meet me. A moment later I came to. An hypnotic voice said, "Five!" emphatically, and I lay there, hazily watching a dark red spot of my own blood shaping itself into a butterfly, glistening and soaking into the soiled gray world of the canvas. When the voice drawled, "10! I was lifted up and dragged to a chair. I sat, dazed. My eye pained and swelled with each throb of my pounding heart, and I wondered if now I would be allowed to speak. I was wringing wet, my mouth still bleeding. We were grouped along the wall now. The other boys ignored me as they congratulated Tatlock and speculated as to how much they would be paid. One boy whimpered over his smashed hand. Looking up front, I saw attendants in white jackets rolling the portable ring away and placing a small square rug in the vacant space surrounded by chairs. Perhaps, I thought, I will stand on the rug to deliver my speech. Then the MC called to us, "Come on up here, boys, and get your money." We ran forward to where the men laughed and talked in their chairs, waiting. Everyone seemed friendly now. "There it is, on the rug," the man said. I saw the rug covered with coins of all dimensions and a few crumpled bills. But what excited me, scattered here and there, were the gold pieces. "Boys, it's all yours," the man said. "You get all you grab." "That's right, Sambo," a blond man said, winking at me confidentially. I trembled with excitement, forgetting my pain. I would get the gold and the bills, I thought. I would use both hands. I would throw my body against the boys nearest to me to block them from the gold. "Get down around the rug now," the man commanded, "and don't anyone touch it until I give the signal." "This ought to be good," I heard. As told, we got around the square rug on our knees. Slowly the man raised his freckled hand as we followed it upward with our eyes. I heard, "These niggas look like they're about to pray." Then, "Ready?" the man said. "Go!" I lunged for a yellow coin lying on the blue design of the carpet, touching it and sending a surprised shriek to join those rising around me. I tried frantically to remove my hand, but could not let go. A hot, violent force tore through my body, shaking me like a wet rat. The rug was electrified. The hair bristled up on my head as I shook myself free. My muscles jumped, my nerves jangled, writhed. But I saw that this was not stopping the other boys, laughing in fear and embarrassment. Some were holding back and scooping up the coins knocked off by the painful contortions of the others. The men roared above us as we struggled. "Pick it up, God damn it! Pick it up!" someone called like a bass-voiced parrot. "Go on, get it!" I crawled rapidly around the floor, picking up the coins, trying to avoid the coppers and to get greenbacks and the gold. Ignoring the shock by laughing as I brushed the coins off quickly, I discovered that I could contain the electricity, a contradiction, but it works. Then, the men began to push us onto the rug, laughing embarrassedly. We struggled out of their hands and kept after the coins. We were all wet and slippery and hard to hold. Suddenly I saw a boy lifted into the air, glistening with sweat like a circus seal, and dropped, his wet back landing flush upon the charged rug. Heard him yell and saw him literally dance upon his back, his elbows beating a frenzied tattoo upon the floor, his muscles twitching like the flesh of a horse stung by many flies. When he finally rolled off, his face was gray, and no one stopped him when he ran from the floor amid booming laughter. "Get the money," the MC called. "That's good, hard American cash." And we snatched and grabbed, snatched and grabbed. I was careful not to come too close to the rug now. And when I felt the hot whiskey breath descend upon me like a cloud of foul air, I reached out and grabbed the leg of a chair. It was occupied, and I held on desperately. "Let go, nigga, let go!" The huge face wavered down to mine as he tried to push me free, but my body was slippery, and he was too drunk. It was Mr. Coldcord, who owned a chain of movie houses and entertainment palaces. Each time he grabbed me, I slipped out of his hands. It became a real struggle. I feared the rug more than I did the drunk, so I held on, surprising myself for a moment by trying to topple him upon the rug. It was such an enormous idea that I found myself actually carrying it out. I tried not to be obvious, yet when I grabbed his leg, trying to tumble him out of the chair, he raised up roaring with laughter and, looking at me with soberness dead in the eye, kicked me viciously in the chest. The chair leg flew out of my hand and I felt myself going and rolled. It was as though I had rolled through a bed of hot coals. It seemed a whole century would pass before I would roll free, a century in which I was seared through the deepest levels of my body to the fearful breath within me, and the breath seared and heated to the point of explosion. "It'll all be over in a flash," I thought as I rolled clear. "It'll all be over in a flash." But not yet. The men on the other side were waiting, red faces swollen as though from apoplexy, as they bent forward in their chairs. Seeing their fingers coming toward me, I rolled away as a fumbled football rolls off the receiver's fingertips back into the coals. That time I luckily sent the rug sliding out of place and heard the coins ringing against the floor and the boys scuffling to pick them up and the MC calling, "All right, boys, that's all. Go get dressed and get your money." I was limp as a dish rag. My back felt as though it had been beaten with wires. When we had dressed, the MC came in and gave us each $5, except Tadlock, who got 10 for being last in the ring. Then he told us to leave. I was not to get a chance to deliver my speech, I thought. I was going out into the dim alley in despair when I was stopped and told to go back. I returned to the ballroom where the men were pushing back their chairs and gathering in groups to talk. The MC knocked on a table for quiet. "Gentlemen," he said, "we almost forgot an important part of the program. A most serious part, gentlemen. This boy was brought here to deliver a speech which he made at his graduation yesterday. Bravo! I'm told that he is the smartest boy we've got out there in Greenwood. I'm told that he knows more big words than a pocket-sized dictionary." Much applause and laughter. "So now, gentlemen, I want you to give him your attention." There was still laughter as I faced them, my mouth dry, my eye throbbing. I began slowly, but evidently my throat was tense because they began shouting, "Louder! Louder! We of the younger generation extol the wisdom of the great leader and educator," I shouted, "who first spoke these flaming words of wisdom.
A ship, lost at sea for many days, suddenly sighted a friendly vessel. From the mast of the unfortunate vessel was seen a signal. Water! Water! We die of thirst! The answer from the friendly vessel came back. Cast down your bucket where you are. The captain of the distressed vessel, at last heeding the injunction, cast down his bucket, and it came up full of fresh, sparkling water from the mouth of the Amazon River. And like him, I say, and in his words, to those of my race who depend upon bettering their condition in a foreign land, or who underestimate the importance of cultivating friendly relations with the southern white man, who is his next-door neighbor, I would say, cast down your bucket where you are. Cast it down in making friends in every manly way of the people of all races by whom we are surrounded.
I spoke automatically and with such fervor that I did not realize that the men were still talking and laughing until my dry mouth, filling up with blood from the cut, almost strangled me. I coughed, wanting to stop and go to one of the tall, brass, sand-filled spittoons to relieve myself, but a few of the men, especially the superintendent, were listening, and I was afraid. So I gulped it down, blood, saliva, and all, and continued. What powers of endurance I had during those days! What enthusiasm! What a belief in the rightness of things! I spoke even louder in spite of the pain, but still they talked, and still they laughed as though deaf with cotton in dirty ears, so I spoke with greater emotional emphasis. I closed my ears and swallowed blood until I was nauseated. The speech seemed 100 times as long as before, but I could not leave out a single word. All had to be said, each memorized, nuanced, considered, rendered. Nor was that all. Whenever I uttered a word of 3 or more syllables, a group of voices would yell for me to repeat it. I used the phrase social responsibility, and they yelled,
"What's that word you say, boy?" "Social responsibility," I said. "What? Social? Louder! Responsibility! More! Repeatability!"
The room filled with the uproar of laughter until, no doubt, distracted by having to gulp down my blood, I made a mistake and yelled a phrase I had often seen denounced in newspaper editorials, heard debated in private.
"Social what?" they yelled. "Equality!"
The laughter hung smoke-like in the sudden stillness. I opened my eyes, puzzled. Sounds of displeasure filled the room. The MC rushed forward. They shouted hostile phrases at me, but I did not understand. A small, dry, mustached man in the front row blared out, "Say that slowly, son."
"What, sir?"
"What you just said."
"Social responsibility, sir," I said.
"You weren't being smart, were you, boy?" he said, not unkindly.
"No, sir."
"You sure that about equality was a mistake?"
"Oh, yes, sir," I said. I was swallowing blood.
"Well, you had better speak more slowly so we can understand. We mean to do right by you, but you've got to know your place at all times. All right, now, go on with your speech." I was afraid. I wanted to leave, but I wanted also to speak, and I was afraid they'd snatch me down.
Thank you, sir,"
I said, beginning where I had left off and having them ignore me as before. Yet when I finished, there was a thunderous applause. I was surprised to see the superintendent come forth with a package wrapped in white tissue paper and, gesturing for quiet, address the men.
"Gentlemen, you see that I did not overpraise this boy. He makes a good speech, and someday he'll lead his people in the proper paths. And I don't have to tell you that that is important in these days and times. This is a good, smart boy. And so to encourage him in the right direction, in the name of the Board of Education, I wish to present him a prize in the form of this..." He paused, removing the tissue paper and revealing a gleaming calfskin briefcase. "In the form of this first-class article from Shad Whitmore Shop. Boy," he said, addressing me, "take this prize and keep it well. Consider it a badge of office. Prize it. Keep developing as you are, and someday it will be filled with important papers that will help shape the destiny of your people."
I was so moved that I could hardly express my thanks. A rope of bloody saliva forming a shape like an undiscovered continent drooled upon the leather, and I wiped it quickly away. I felt an importance that I had never dreamed.
"Open it and see what's inside," I was told.
My fingers a-tremble, I complied, smelling the fresh leather and finding an official-looking document inside. It was a scholarship to the State College for Negroes. My eyes filled with tears, and I ran awkwardly off the floor. I was overjoyed. I did not even mind when I discovered that the gold pieces I had scrambled for were brass pocket tokens advertising a certain